Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. This time, award-winning author, editor, and retired Foreign Service officer Peter Cousins talks about his latest book, Deadwood, Gold, Guns, and Greed in the American West. It was published by Knopf in August 2025. Peter Cousins was interviewed by fellow biographer and bio member John, better known as Jack, Farrell.
Peter, how are you?
Doing well, my friend.
Good. We're with the third most famous baby boomer from Wheaton, Illinois, after John Belushi and
Bob Woodward.
That's right.
There
Bob Woodward, John Belushi, and also the home of Billy Graham.
That's right. And John Belushi grew up about five blocks away from our house. I knew him or anything, but he lived close by.
So what is it about this staid Midwestern town that produces somebody like yourself who has written or edited 18 books? Is that what we're up to now?
20 now, actually.
Oh, my goodness.
I have to count myself sometimes.
So there's a story on the internet from which all wisdom is gained that says that you began your writing career as a denizen of a bookstore.
Yep. When I was 16, 17, 18 years old, I used to skip classes from Wheaton Central High School to go downtown either to a Cubs game like Ferris Bueller or to the Abraham Lincoln Bookshop, which remains to this day. It's probably the leading bookshop in the country for Abraham Lincoln, Americana, the Civil War. And at the time, I became friends with the gentleman who worked there, who went on to purchase the shop from its then owner and is still the owner today, Dan Weinberg. And when I wrote my manuscript for my first book, No Better Place to Die, I was only in my late 20s. I had no idea how to get published. And Dan took me under his wing and sent it to the director of the University of Illinois Press. And off it went.
Well, you've had three interesting careers. You were a U.S. Army captain, a Foreign Service officer during the Reagan years. And then throughout all that time, you began to work as an author. And what was it that drove you to spend your evenings scribbling while you were pursuing these other careers?
After my first book was published, I just realized that that was my true love. And in a way, it actually was beneficial being overseas because I had a maid. Once I was off work at 5 o'clock and got done working out at the gym, my evenings were my own, as were my weekends. And in particular, when I was in Peru for 3 years during the days of Sendero Luminoso, Shining Path Terrorism, there wasn't a heck of a lot to do besides sit in one's apartment. So I was able to get an entire book done during my tour there. But it was just a matter of it being a driving passion, actually much more so than the Foreign Service. I took tours that would, instead of a normal 3-year tour, I would take 4-year tours to give me more stability to allow continuity in my projects.
So your first field of expertise was the Civil War. And I think one of my favorite books of yours is still The Terrible Sound, The Battle of Chickamauga. And you did 5 books on the Civil War. Did you import the books? I mean, this was the days before the internet. You were 1,000 miles away from the places you were writing about. How did you do the research? Did you take leave time to come back and visit the battlefields?
I did. I also took leave to visit archives. I was fortunate in that my alma mater, Knox College, had one of the premier Civil War book collections in the country. And I was able to do a lot of research visiting my alma mater. And I have to confess that my mother also did a lot of the research for me, you know, tracked down scarce articles on interlibrary loan, requested scarce books on interlibrary loan, photocopied like crazy, and, you know, sent me these big reams of photocopies. So it was a combination of my mother's help, becoming well acquainted with a number of archivists who, of course, went above and beyond the call of duty and sending me materials, and then taking leave to actually visit the battlefields. Because, I mean, there's no way you can write a credible account of a battle or really any other significant historical happening without seeing the ground. Just as in Deadwood, I spent a total of about 5 weeks combing every inch of the Black Hills that had any relevance at all to the subject.
Yeah, that's remarkable. So now, as an Army officer, could you use that to plug like the resources of the Army History College at Carlisle? And did it also give you a perspective as an Army officer to write those books that you might otherwise not have had? And I just want to say this was before Ken Burns and the Civil War came out.
And I think was one of the pioneers of deeper, more profound research in Civil War books too, taking that extra step to look underneath the surface of published materials and archive materials. But I think being an Army officer was definitely an asset. You know, I resigned my commission when I was a captain, so I never got a grand tactical view of anything. But I think it still helps to understand the language. I mean, much hasn't changed in 100 plus years in terms of tactical language. And it helped me picture the battlefield and evaluate the battlefield, especially the terrain, in ways that I would not have if I had not had that training in terrain evaluation that I got in the military.
So you went into the Foreign Service, you were in Central America, in Costa Rica. Yeah. And then in Peru, and this is the Reagan years. And for your service, you were given an award, which I've never asked you about, but it's the highest decoration that the Foreign Service gives. And it's for moral courage, integrity, and creative dissent. Is there a story there that I don't know?
There's a story there. Unfortunately, a lot of it's classified. But in a nutshell, I was very outspoken in my opposition to an administration policy at great risk to my career. And for that, I was recognized with the award. It was an award given by the American Foreign Service Association, which is the sort of like the union of the Foreign mm-hmm. Service, the umbrella organization for Foreign Service officers.
Yeah. Before we get to Deadwood, and actually before we get to your first biography, which is a biography of Civil War General John Pope.
Right.
A few years back, you sort of shocked your pals in a magazine, in Bethesda Magazine, when you talked about the fact that your writing was fueled by what was later diagnosed as bipolar disorder. And I'm fascinated at the ability of folks functioning with that. But how did you come to grips with that? And again, I'm not asking for a voyeuristic point of view, but I do think that we have young writers out there who deal with depression and deal with manic disorder.
When I look back on the books that I published while I was in the Foreign Service, and I was not diagnosed with bipolar disorder until 2006, when I hit a really bad depression. And I really feel like for all the years from the year my first book was published, 1990, to 2005, I was on about a 15-year manic rush, in the sense that I have not since been on medication and well treated for the illness. I have never been able to attain that level of productivity in the sense of being able to write books so quickly, to have virtually first drafts come out as a finished project. And I guess there was that upside to it. If I had not had bipolar disorder, or if it had been treated earlier, I don't think I could have attained the level of productivity with the rapidness that I did. I mean, I've since published, of course, 5 books, but it's been, instead of, you know, a book every 2 years, it's been a book every 3 or 4 years. And it's involved more effort. I have to do a lot more rewriting than I did in the past. But obviously the upside of getting it treated is well worth it.
Yeah. Following that, seems to me the biggest gap as I look at the resume is Before the Earth is Weeping, which is your prize-winning tour de force of Native Americans and the U.S. Army and the American West. And that one took, what, 6 years?
Yeah.
It shows. It's a spectacular, wonderful book, well deserved of the prizes that it won.
Thank you, Jack.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, what led to the switch from the Civil War to Native Americans?
Actually, General Pope did. I had discovered General Pope was an up-and-coming Union general in the Civil War who was defeated by Robert E. Lee at the Second Battle of Manassas and then shipped out west to a sort of exile. And I discovered in a little-known late 19th century newspaper his serialized memoirs. And so I got a contract to edit his memoirs from University Press in North Carolina. And I sat down intending just to write a brief biographical sketch as a prelude to the memoirs. And after I got to about page 100, I realized maybe this will be a full-fledged biography. And what really attracted me to Pope was his affinity for the American Indians and his conviction that they were being mistreated and his repulsion at the Army's duties in pacifying the Indians when he well realized that they were not at fault in any of the conflicts in the West. He was a departmental commander, so he exercised authority over a large part of the West. And then I began to look at other Civil War generals who went on to careers in the West, and most of them felt the same way. That was a real surprise to me, to find that most Civil War generals were sympathetic to the Indians. And that was kind of the segue into my interest in the American Indians in the West. And my interest in the Indians grew to encompass the remainder of the U.S.
So the next book was Tecumseh and the Prophet. But I can't think of something tougher than to do the research on Native American where you don't have any, much less a wealth of written records and recollections.
Well, you know, it wasn't difficult when I was writing The Earth is Weeping, when I tried to tell a story in a balanced way from both Indian and white perspectives, so to speak, because by the late 19th century, especially in the post-Indian Wars years, there were a lot of ethnologists and others who interviewed Indian participants. There were several Indians who dictated their memoirs. There were congressional hearings held on conflicts in which Indians were actually invited to testify. There were transcripts from treaty negotiations. So it was very easy for the late 19th century. The further back you go, the harder it becomes. And in the case of Tecumseh and his brother Tenskwatawa, this was a dual biography. It was extremely difficult. I had to piece together as best I could their lives, again, from things like treaty negotiations, from the recollections of whites who knew them. And there were plenty of those. Of course, you have to evaluate the credibility and the prejudice of the whites who are writing about them. Fortunately, there was a great deal among British records of British Canada, of Canadian officials' dealings with Tecumseh and Tenskwatawa. There was a Kentuckian who, from age 12 into his 20s, was adopted into Tecumseh's family and left a marvelous memoir of his time with Tecumseh and Tenskwatawa. That proved an invaluable source. But it was really difficult. I mean, there was no one, two, three, or four major sources that I could rely on. And also, I benefited from a lot of good works on Shawnee culture. So I could extrapolate a lot of what their early lives were probably like through an understanding of Shawnee culture and what the experiences of Shawnee youth in general might have been.
Well, that's tough just by itself, whether the researchers there are not getting into the heads of an entirely different kind of people with an entirely different kind of experience. Is there any advice you have for writers trying to do that?
Yes. I mean, take as deep a dive as possible into literature about the culture, society, and ways of life of the people. Immerse yourself in it, which I did before I even started researching Tecumseh and his brother. I immersed myself in all the literature I could about Shawnee and Great Lakes Indian culture in general, so I could try to understand, you know, as best as possible, their points of view. I think that's absolutely critical.
Yeah, I think you also give your Native American subjects the recognition and the credit of allowing them to stand on their own and judging them like you would any person rather than wrapping them up in sort of a false mythic sentimentality.
I tried. I mean, I tried to judge them in light of their cultures and their societies, and so they would stand or fall in terms of their cultural norms.
Yeah, the whole tale is tragic, but that doesn't mean that the tragic hero doesn't have flaws. In fact, that's what makes tragedy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then you went out and got a book contract to do a book on the Creeks, which are moving a little bit further south into the deep interior south from the Shawnee, and then introduce us to somebody who is either a great hero on the $20 bill, Andrew Jackson, but has also in recent years become more of a controversial figure, and that's Andrew Jackson. How did you navigate that particular roller coaster?
Andrew Jackson was difficult to navigate. I mean, he's a really enigmatic character. I mean, on one hand, there's no questioning his personal courage. He was peerless in that respect. On the other hand, we have to judge him within the context of his time. But even within that context, his desire to absorb Indian land and exploit Indian land went a little bit above and beyond the norm. And you had to juxtapose that with his desire to protect the Deep South, which again was then completely controlled by American Indian tribes, to prevent the Deep South from becoming, by extension, an Indian domain, because this, after all, was a war of 1812. So he was very difficult to navigate. And I don't think I really never quite came to terms with him in a sense of being able to say in one sentence, Andrew Jackson was this or that. He was a very complex man, and I hope I was able to convey all his complexities in the book. One faction of the Creek Indians, the Red Sticks, who were his opponent in the Creek War. And the Creek War, I should say, was the most consequential Indian war in the United States history, because it decided the fate of all of Alabama, almost the entire western half of Georgia, as well as Mississippi. All these areas were either in Creek hands or those of associated tribes. When it came to researching and understanding the Creeks, it was actually a lot easier than it was for the Shawnee and the other tribes north of the Ohio, because there had been a lot of intermarriage among the Creeks, and a lot of the Creeks were fluent in English, actually wrote correspondence in English, and that helped me immensely in navigating the Creek Indian sources.
Yeah, some of the Indian agents are actually part Indian, and so they have names like the actual Indians have names like McIlvaney or McGillicuddy or
William McIntosh. My favorite, Paddy Walsh, could be straight out of an Irish pub.
Exactly. Yeah. And then we come to the fun part, which is this little town in South Dakota called Deadwood. And you move away from the American Indian story in the West to your first venture into a Wild West saga. And I think it was interesting that the book is almost laid out like a biography of a town. Childhood, maturity, and what lies in between. Did you have that in mind when you went into the project?
Not initially, but I saw how it naturally fell into that category. At the time of which I write, the three-year period from 1876 to 1879, which was the time of the Wild West, where the dead would be associated with lawlessness and violence. Was compressed in a very small period, but I divided the town into its infancy when it was first settled, and its adolescence, which unfortunately was cut short by a tragic fire that burnt the town to the ground. But I think you can see where it was kind of a reciprocal relationship there between the town and its inhabitants.
So we begin the story, and I guess the first people we need to talk about when you talk about Deadwood is Crazy Horse, Sitting Bull, and the Sioux, because this all started with the conquest of the West and the veneration that the Sioux had for the Black Hills.
Right, and the plight of the Lakota Sioux, who were dispossessed of the Black Hills during the course of the story, that theme runs as an undercurrent throughout the entire book. In fact, I bookend the story with the experiences of a Lakota mystic. And you can't really consider Deadwood without having an understanding of what it meant to the Lakota, what the loss of the Black Hills meant to them, and just what an incredible injustice was done them by the U.S. government in depriving them of the Black Hills.
Compared to like the Yukon Gold Rush or the California Gold Rush or South Africa, was the amount of gold taken out of the Black Hills worth it?
I would put in the category of a good, solid Western strike that came at a good time, just after the Panic of 1873, when the country was still in a depression. There hadn't been a gold strike in over a decade. And you know, we were on the gold standard. So the economy could only grow as the gold supply grew. And so that infusion of gold from the Black Hills, which was several billion dollars in today's money, it was not insignificant. But a lot of the gold never made it outside of Deadwood. You had gold miners and you had the people who mined the miners, like the saloon keepers, brothel owners, and so forth. And a lot of the miners who struck it rich ended up frittering away their money on women, gambling, and drink. And so the money never got much farther than Deadwood.
There was that one guy, was his name Hubbard? He was the one guy who like kept the gold, put it in the saddlebags, hired guards, and ended up having like a 19-horse train out and really managed to have the discipline to get the gold all the way to Philadelphia.
Right. He took out $500,000 in 1876 money. I can't do the conversion right now, but it was significant. The early miners in Deadwood, the so-called placer miners, you know, the ones you imagine, you know, the guys with picks and shovels and pans and the creek beds, those were the miners during the wild frontier days of Deadwood. When mining became more sophisticated, when people like George Hearst brought in big capital from California to develop the mines deeper, then you got some real wealth because a number of the small claims became what was called the Homestake Mine, which was the richest gold mine and longest running in American history. So there was a lot of gold there, but it didn't necessarily all come out during the time of, you know, frontier Deadwood.
Yeah. So the next figure that walks onto the stage is George Armstrong Custer. And how much of the initial, oh my God, there's gold in the Black Hills, came from Custer himself? And how much was the Chicago newspapers or just general hysteria?
Well, there had long been rumors about gold existing in the Black Hills. I mean, those rumors went back to the early 19th century. You know, Lakota would come out of the Black Hills carrying gold and mistakenly making whites aware of it. But there was no concerted effort to exploit it because it was Lakota land. After the Panic of 1873, the pressure to open the Black Hills began to grow. And Custer, in 1874, he was charged by his commander, General Phil Sheridan, to go into the Black Hills to scout a location for a military post from which the Army could keep a better eye on what were called the roaming Lakota. These were Indians who lived off the reservation, but still on land given them by treaty. That was the ostensible purpose of his trip into the Black Hills, but he took two miners with him. Whether or not at his own expense is not known, but they discovered gold in small quantities in the central Black Hills. And initially it was a Chicago reporter who really overplayed the amount of gold that had been discovered. Custer at first himself was rather circumspect, but he got caught up in it all too. And he began promoting the notion of large quantities of gold to be taken out of the Black Hills as well. And he got his comeuppance for all this. Ironically, it was the Great Sioux War in which he died at the Little Bighorn was provoked by the Grant administration to try to get the Lakota Sioux to part with the Black Hills, which was part of the reservation and belonged to the Lakota by treaty, but they wouldn't sell. And the government wasn't offering particularly fair price. So the Grant administration provoked the war. And that was the war in which Custer perished.
And right at the peak of the big Deadwood summer, right? The summer
actually, the peak of the first summer of Deadwood scared the hell out of the people of Deadwood. They really feared that the Indians would come and overwhelm Deadwood. Most particularly, Crazy Horse had been born in the Black Hills, was devoted to the Black Hills even more than you know many other Lakota. But the reason why the Lakota weren't able to put up a better fight for the Black Hills is that they were busy fighting the Army and didn't have the resources to drive the settlers and gold miners out of the Black Hills.
I love also the parallel story of the little town of Custer City, which is the first illegal mining town. And then it vanishes in, what, a week when everybody moves to Deadwood. And Deadwood goes from 40 people to 200 buildings in what, a couple of months that spring.
Exactly. The pace at which things moved. It was absolutely remarkable. It's really hard to get your head around it. In fact, it was hard for the residents of Deadwood, too. I mean, one resident who lived into the 20th century said it was like living in a motion picture. Things happened so quickly. And another said it was like living 10 years in 1 year. I mean, things just happened so quickly.
And you get this great image of three wagons coming in with gambling paraphernalia and five card sharks and a bunch of soiled doves coming into Deadwood and immediately setting up one of the first saloons.
There's also Wild Bill Hickok and his buddy Colorado Charlie Utter, who had a caravan about the same time that was composed principally of gamblers, soiled doves, would-be saloon keeps, and other assorted riffraff.
Yeah, the soiled doves are the prostitutes that haunted the mining camps all over the West. That was their euphemistic description. And one of them, and a fascinating character in the book, is somebody in that first group with Wild Bill was Calamity Jane.
Yeah, absolutely. Calamity Jane, I mean, we could talk for hours about her. She was another enigma. She, on the one hand, was a prostitute. She had a very, very rough childhood. She was orphaned and began to work as a prostitute at age 12. Was an alcoholic. But through a series of events, she became, before the age of 22, a national celebrity. She had a real gift for self-promotion, and she was able to get the attention of the author of a book who was doing research on the Black Hills to promote the Black Hills in 1877. And he was completely enamored of this fictionalized story of herself that she liked to tell, that she had been an Army scout, had been a trick shooter, had actually been married to a wealthy rancher, was a stage driver, onward, on and on. All these things were false. But he bought into it and published a book in which she appeared as a central character, as an heroic frontier heroine. And then other journalists and other the news media picked up on that. And within a year or two, the legend of Calamity Jane was created. And she also began to appear in dime novels, which were the pulp fiction of the day. And so, again, before age 22, she was already a national celebrity, which mystified people in Deadwood who knew her as pretty much a common prostitute. But to her credit, Calamity Jane had a real warm side about her, too. She tended to smallpox victims in 1876 when Deadwood was hit by a severe smallpox epidemic when nobody else except one lone doctor would attend to the victims. She was really good-hearted. And despite her harsh upbringing, a tragic character because at her heart, she was a good person.
Yeah.
It's interesting. She came to Deadwood because Wild Bill Hickok and Charlie Utter, before they left Fort Laramie outside of Cheyenne, Wyoming, with their caravan, the officer of the day asked them to take one more prostitute off his hands. And sure enough, it was Calamity Jane.
And Hickok meets his demise famously.
Wild Bill Hickok had come to Deadwood for one last chance at making a go of it. He was on the skids. He had been fired from his job as a lawman in Kansas. He was meandering around the West, drinking and gambling. His eyesight was failing him, which, of course, for a gunslinger, that's a pretty serious matter. And he decided to go to the Black Hills and try to make a go of it as a gambler. And he encountered this ne'er-do-well named Jack McCall in a poker game in the number 10 saloon and bested him at poker one evening. McCall didn't have the money to pay Hickok for his losses. And the next day, McCall comes in to where Hickok is playing cards again and shoots him in the back of the head. There were rumors that the lawless element in Deadwood was afraid that Wild Bill might become town sheriff or marshal and bring order to town and threaten their livelihoods. But I think Hickok made it pretty abundantly clear that all he wanted to do was drink and play cards, that his gunslinging days were over. That's one theory, and that, you know, this element hired Jack McCall to kill Wild Bill. At his trial, which was held in Deadwood, McCall claimed to have killed Wild Bill because Wild Bill had killed his brother and had threatened to kill Jack McCall. The jury bought that, and acquitted McCall. The problem with that was McCall had no brother, and he boasted about that fact after he left Deadwood. And he was subsequently rearrested and tried for murder in Yankton, the territorial capital, found guilty and hanged. And it wasn't a case of double jeopardy because the court in Deadwood had no legal standing because Deadwood was an illegal settlement on Indian land.
Yeah. So how much did the Deadwood television show influence where you were going to go with your research?
The series was one of the things that motivated me to write the book. I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed the series. I didn't go into the book intending to bust any myths or dispel any legends about Deadwood, because going into it, I wasn't quite sure what was legend and what wasn't. And, you know, a lot of the characters were, to one degree or another, fictionalized for the purpose of the show. But by and large, with a couple of exceptions, the show captured the spirit of these people.
Well, Peter, thanks so much for visiting with us.
Thank you so much, Jack.
You bet.
That was author and editor Peter Cousins speaking with John Farrell about his latest book, Deadwood, Gold, Guns, and Greed in the American West. It was published by Knopf in August 2025, and this interview was recorded via Zoom in December of last year. To learn more about Bio, or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. Ellian Marie Fillengaines created our theme music. Jenny Skoog is our producer. Carolyn Van Putten, assistant producer. And Shireen Newman is our engineer. I'm executive producer Sonia Williams. And until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a wonderful day.